So this is the last shiur for this season. Thank you all very much for your participation.
I really enjoyed our
time together. And I wanted to speak about something related to the upcoming holiday of Shavuos. So we have the whole story of Rus and Boaz and something going on over there that sounds a little bit like Yibum. But Yibum is a very specifically defined mitzvah in the Torah that we have here in Devarim Perek Chafei. It speaks about if there are two brothers that are both alive in the world at the same time, and one of the brothers dies without any children, he's married, so then the other brother is supposed to stand in his shoes, so to speak, and marry the widow, and that's called the Yibum. And if the brother does not want to stand in his brother's shoes and marry the widow, so the Torah has a ceremony where the widow takes off the shoe from a special shoe, a specially designed shoe, the chalson alo me'araglo. She takes off the shoe from the brother-in-law's foot to symbolize, presumably, that he's not prepared to step into his brother's shoes in order to continue his legacy, to bear the children that his brother was not able to bear. And that act is called chalitza. Chalitza consists of really three different parts. One is the taking off of the shoe, which is the main mitzvah of chalitza. That's the word chalitza means a removal of the shoe. V'chaltzon ha'alo mi'araglo. It also consists of kriyas ha'psukim. The Torah tells us very specifically which lines in the script are supposed to be uttered by the widow. By which lines are supposed to be uttered by the brother-in-law that refuses to perform Yibum, and which lines are uttered by everybody who's standing around. Everybody, you have a group of people who are gathered there, and they all say, this is the home of the person who had the shoe taken off of his foot, rather than stepping into his brother's shoes and footsteps, as it were. And that's the chalitza ceremony. But this all takes place when there is a surviving brother. If there's no surviving brother, there's no mitzvah of Yibum, there's no mitzvah of chalitza. But we have a couple of stories in Tanakh that seem to indicate that there was, perhaps, if not Yibum, some parallel track that was going on. And we have that in Sefer Rus. Sefer Rus is the Acha Matan Torah. So presumably the laws of Yibum applied. There were two brothers, Machlon Michulion. They both died, and Machlon left his widow, who was Rus, and Naomi, who was the mother-in-law, explained to Rus that you need to have geula, you need to have a redemption. There was some sort of a ceremony that was described as geula, that in Lo Yigal, that somebody has to take over the heritage, the place of her brother, who is the closest relative. And then there was some type of a deliberation. Who was the closest relative? It was like a first cousin of Machlon, who would be the closest relative in order to perform the geula ceremony. And at the end of the day, there was some Ploni Amoni, who was the designated individual, but he didn't want to do it. So since he didn't want to do it, so Boaz ended up being the next person in line to perform the geula, and he performed the geula with Rus. And we have this same idea in Parshas Bereishis, which is Kodem Matan Torah, where it's a relationship that would be more problematic from a Lachar to Matan Torah perspective in terms of Yehuda and Tamar, where Yehuda had a son who was married to Tamar. That son died, so then the next son in line. First he had Er, then Onan took the place of Er in order to marry this same woman, Tamar. Then after he died, so Tamar waited around for the next brother, who was Shelah, but Shelah was not forthcoming. And eventually it was Yehuda himself, who was the father-in-law, who performed this act of geula, this act of redemption on some level. The Ramban Alachumish describes this at some length of what was going on over here. It was some type of a precursor to Yibum. And yet, both a precursor, and yet at the same time, we also had the same idea to some degree later on with respect to Rus and Boaz. So it wasn't actually Yibum, but it was something along the lines of a Yibum. So very often when we read the story of Rus and Boaz, we think about Yibum. We also think about Chalitza, but really there was no Chalitza going on in the story of a Rus. The reason why we think about Chalitza was because there was a Kinyan there was some type of, as part of the geula process, in terms of the acquisition of property, there was some type of a kinyan that took place with a na'al, with a shoe, but that is really totally separate and distinct, as the Abavanel points out. That's totally separate and distinct from chalitza. It just sounds a little bit like chalitza because you have the word shoe in there. But that is the, you know, that's zos lefnim Yisrael agula v'latmar l'kayem kol devash libish nalom yavaglo nasan reyeu. That is not really chalitza per se. And yet, the entire ceremony that's going on over there, the entire story, certainly evokes the notion of geula, of stepping in for one's family member. And the Ramban gives this all kinds of Kabbalistic connotations and says there's a great sod. Sometimes the Ramban will do that. Al HaTorah, and nobody really understands what the Ramban is talking about. He says, he has this in his introduction as well, that he's going to sprinkle some Kabbalah. This is really one of the earliest appearances of Kabbalah, is in the writings of the Ramban. He's going to sprinkle in some Kabbalah, even though the Zohar, I don't think, was even published at that point in time. You may have had the Hilula de Rashbi that Rabbi Shimon Yochai was inspired with, the Sefer Zohar, but it wasn't actually published until later on. Moshe de Leon published the manuscript of the Zohar a little bit later on, but you certainly had notions of the learning of Kabbalah, and the Ramban says there's a great sod over here, and later authorities of Beinu Bakhtia explain that the sod really that the Ramban was alluding to was some type of a sod of transmigration of souls, of what we might call Gilgal, what we might call reincarnation, that through the act of Yibum, there's some type of a reincarnation process which is going on, and therefore it's very, very mystical. But because of the fact that it's very mystical, so some of the later authorities also got a little bit worried on a metaphysical level about some of the implications of the relationship of a widow with her brother-in-law after her husband would die, even if, let's say, the widow did not want to remarry. She didn't want to do Yibum, and she didn't really need Chalitza because she wouldn't have any interest in remarrying. So some said because the Zohar creates this very powerful connection, this metaphysical connection between the brother-in-law and the sister-in-law, so if they don't want to necessarily go to their graves with that metaphysical connection, maybe it's a good idea to sever the bond anyway, what we call the Zika, the bond, maybe it's a good idea to sever that bond with Chalitza so that the sister-in-law can be released, even if she doesn't want to marry somebody else, which is what Chalitza would accomplish. It would enable her to marry somebody else. Even if she doesn't want that, nonetheless, maybe it's a good idea for them to be released from each other. So the Chassam Sofer spoke about that, actually, because he had a case where there was an old lady who became a widow because her husband died. They didn't have any children, and there was a brother, and the question was, she didn't really want to go through the whole rigmarole of a Chalitza ceremony, but nonetheless, is it a good idea for her to do it anyway, because of all of the metaphysical implications. So if you take a look at source 12, for example, here we're talking about the Chassam Sofer, Chelek Daled, Eben Ezer, Simon Bey, Hey. So he says, Es Asher Osa Nafshe Yafa Ados Yavim Yavam Zekein and Bayim Bayamim. You have a very old couple, the sister-in-law and brother-in-law, are very an old couple. She's Skimushneim, he died to his son, Shuli Yavim Lolachlots. They have no interest in doing Yibum, they have no interest in doing Chalitza, they just will remain single for the rest of their lives. There's no interest in going through their ceremony. They don't want to go through the ceremony because it's a little bit embarrassing to go through a whole Chalitza ceremony. You have to have at least a minion of people who are present for the Chalitza ceremony because it's supposed to be an event. Also, Yibimto Hashara El Zakenim, as the Torah says. So it's not me'akev to have 10 people, but you need to have at least a bezin, you need to have a Zakenim, you should have Eidim, you should have witnesses. So pretty soon you end up with 10 people anyway. It used to be that in certain places, whenever, this is still true, in certain communities, that it's such a rare event to have a chalitza, where you have all of the circumstances come together, that there is a man who dies without children, leaves a widow, and he leaves a brother, and now in order for the widow to get remarried, she could do Yibum, we'll get to that in a moment, with the brother-in-law. We don't practice Yibum nowadays, certainly not in the Ashkenazic community, we don't practice Yibum, but she has the option of doing this chalitza ceremony. So since it's such a rare occurrence, it happened more frequently in Europe. We had more men who died young, and you had more childless couples, so it was more common in Europe. Here it's not nearly as common, but when it happens, so lots of people want to watch, because it's an event. It's a spectacle to see a chalitza. So I remember when I was approximately 20 years old, maybe 19, I was a talmid in the yeshiva, and Rav Melech Shechter, Zichrono Levracha, who was the father of Rav Hershel Shechter, brother of the Chaim Tovim, so he was a dayan, and he used to do gittin, and he would do chalitzas. I remember I watched him do a get once, and he was doing a chalitza, and all the talmidim were invited to come in. It was on the fifth floor of first hall at YU, and you had maybe 300 students who all gathered around. We were all watching the chalitza, but a chalitza can be a little bit of a daunting experience from a personal perspective for the people who are going through it, because there's the spinning on the ground is one of the three components of the ceremony. There's the removal of the shoe, spinning on the ground where the lady, the widow, is expected to expectorate on the ground in the presence of the brother-in-law. That's a, you know, an important part of the procedure, and it could be somewhat inhibiting, but nonetheless, since it was an event, so all 300 of these young students all gathered around to watch the chalitza. So you should know that in my years at the Beis Din, I presided over approximately 20 chalitzas, around one a year, over the past 20 years or so. And generally speaking, we do not have a giant stadium filled with people for the chalitza, because my experience has taught me that people who are going through it are generally very private and sensitive about there not being too much of a crowd. So we generally will have just a little bit more than a minyan mitzumtzum. We have the bare minimum that is required according to halacha in order to perform this chalitza process. But says the Chasam Sofer that because of the fact that it's somewhat public, and also it requires work. But what is the sister-in-law has to actually physically remove the shoe from the brother-in-law's foot, and she has to do it without his assistance, because it says v'chotza na'alo, she's supposed to take off the shoe. So that could be hard work. She has to bend down. She's not supposed to put her knees on the ground when she bends down, and she has to pull it off. She has to yank it off. She has to untie. There are clasps and there are loops. And there are knots, and she has to untie all of the knots, the laces, and then the clasps from the loops, and then she has to take off the shoe. So it's hard work, so it's a torach, and it's a busha, and they just didn't want to go through all of it. So it says that the Chasam Sofer, even though the Zohar makes a big deal out of it, so he says, there's no real machlokas between the nigla and the nister over here. Shegama Zohar lo'omu le'mitzvah, she'ena chalisa betorah ki'mitzvah se'esei shogerishin. He says that it's not a mitzvah like you try to find an opportunity to do shiluach hakan. You try to find, like, at least once in your life, the opportunity to send the mother bird away from her chicks. Has everybody done that at least once? Very, very important. Okay, you should really try to do it. So that's what they say. You should try to do it. It's a school of arichos yamim. We had a little red robin, you know, right outside of our door a couple of years ago, and we had the opportunity to do shiluach hakan. Every time we opened up the door, she would fly away off of the nest. So it worked out very well. Some say you have to, kosher bird, and it was a kosher species. Some say you have to actually pick up the eggs or pick up the chicks, but the Chacham Tzvi says it's not necessary, so we were constantly yotzing the mitzvah according to the Chacham Tzvi. So he says this is not a mitzvah that you have to go out of your way to perform. It's like getting divorced. Nobody has the mitzvah to say, I have to be Mekayim the mitzvah of Gerishin at least once in my life. No. It's a good thing not to be Mekayim the mitzvah of Gerishin if you can get away from it. So it's just like mitzvah Gerishin. It just means if you're getting divorced, you're supposed to give again. So here as well, that if this woman wants to remarry, so she should go through chalitza. But it's not necessary to do it. And she just says it's like a gemilas chesed imamesim ukein amimas kaddish. That the Zohar says it's like a segula for the neshama of the mace, but that's why kaddish is a segula, but there's no obligation to require the woman, just like you're not going to require her to say kaddish for her husband, you're not going to require her to go through this chalitza ceremony if it's going to be imhula l'torach or ibn abusha or shuntam, if it's something which is embarrassing or it's inconvenient for her in any way. But most of the cases that we have are where the people do want to go on, the woman does want to get remarried. So the question, the starting question is, which comes first? Which is better? Is it better to do chalitza, or is it better to do yibum? Yes?
So, nowadays, what if the brother doesn't want to bother with the...
So that's very bad. So it's interesting. We always talk about the aguna problem, right? So we're familiar with the aguna problem in the context of a man and woman who get divorced, and the man refuses to give his wife a get. That's kind of the modern-day classical example of the aguna problem. You look in Megillas Rus, Halahein Te Agena, you see a different version of the Aguna problem, which is Rus lost her husband, and she wanted to wait around for a relative of Naomi to marry her instead. The Aguna problem, when Naomi says, Halahein Te Agena, are you going to wait a long time for me to have another child, so that then you would be able to marry that child? The word Aguna is utilized in the context of a woman who is not married to anybody. She's single. But she's an Aguna because she has to wait a long time for her husband. That's also part of the Aguna problem. When you have single women who have a hard time finding their husbands, that also is described in Megillas Rus as an Aguna problem. But we see also that in the context of a Shomeris Yavam type of situation, a woman who is linked to her brother-in-law because she has to either perform Yibum with him or he has to give her Chalitza. If he refuses to give her Chalitza and they're not going to marry each other, so that's another version of what the Gemara refers to as an Aguna case. And many of the situations in the Gemara, where the Gemara says that we want to expedite a get, Shalotzu Benosi Sol Aguna, so a woman won't be an Aguna, it's talking about a man is on his deathbed. He loves his wife very much. If he dies, she's going to be a widow. But the problem is they didn't have any children. He has a brother. And the fear is the brother is overseas. They don't know if they were going to be able to get in touch with the brother. They don't know if the brother is ever going to come and perform Chalitza or Yibum. And that's what's going to cause the woman to be an Aguna. Many of the cases of Aguna that are discussed in the Gemara are in this context. And if you look at the European forms of shtaros that were commonly used, so one of the forms was a form to prevent the Aguna situation, but not the Aguna situation that we think about. If a husband refuses to give his wife a get, the Aguna situation are precisely this type of circumstance where a man dies without children and we're worried that the brother-in-law is nowhere to be found or he's not going to be cooperative anymore, which is sometimes referred to as the achmumer, as the brother who is an apostate, so he's not going to perform a chalitza. And there's a whole literature about, well, maybe if the brother was an apostate at the time of the marriage, so it says, ki yeshvu achim yachdav. You need two brothers, you need two brothers who are sitting together. So what kind of a brother is this? You're not a brother, you're a stranger. A person is an apostate, so maybe he's not considered to really be a brother. So there was a shita like that. So Rabbi Yehudaigon said, well, the mumar is not really a brother, so you don't need to do Yibum or Chalitza, it doesn't count. But the halacha was not really paskin like Rabbi Yehudaigon. So therefore, they had to figure out, what are you going to do in order to avoid those types of situations where you have like an achmumer? So there actually are texts that different rabbis came up with over the years in which they devised a shtaros, where this is in the Nakla Shiva, Simen Chav Beis, contracts that would be signed at the time of the chuppah. We speak about prenuptial agreements. This was not a prenuptial agreement between the husband-to-be and the wife-to-be. This was a prenuptial agreement signed by the brother-in-law, by the brother of the chassan. The brother in the chassan would sign an obligation document in which he would say that in the event that the chassan will die without any children, I take upon myself that I will perform a chalitza, and I will do it without any hafra'os. I'm going to do it without any demands, and I'm going to do it without any ta'anos. I'm going to do it without any claims. Because unfortunately, what would happen sometimes is the brother-in-law would come in, and he would say, yes, sure, I'll do the chalitza, but I don't really like you so much. You're not my flesh and blood. You're my sister-in-law. Maybe you drove my brother to an early grave, in my opinion. There's not necessarily any love lost in every single circumstance between the brother-in-law and the sister-in-law. You want me to give you a chalitza? You want me to release you? So you got to give me 10,000 rubles. You got to give me $10,000. One of my earliest cases of chalitza that I did at the Beis Din of America was a case where the brother-in-law arrived and the sister-in-law arrived, and suddenly I discovered that she has this envelope, and she walks over to us and says, could you hold this envelope? This has, you know, money in it. It has a check that's made out to my brother-in-law, but just please hold it and give it to him at the end of the chalitza procedure, because he had agreed to do it in return for a sum of money. That's not something that we really approve of. It's not supposed to be an opportunity for extortion. So this was a form that was regularly signed. I remember that I was asked by one of the local rabbis in New York City whether this is something that all the rabbis do, because he said whoever trained him to perform weddings, this is Rabbi Alan Schwartz on the Upper West Side, whoever trained him to perform weddings taught him that you have to ask, is there a brother? Is there one brother? Is there more than one brother? And you get at least one brother, if not all of them. to sign this obligation document that a chalitza will be performed. And he actually even gave me a copy of what the document looked like that he had people sign. And I have other than himself, I don't even know if he still does it, maybe he does, but I don't know of any other rabbi that requires this. But it's a really good idea, because you do find situations of aguna of this sort when somebody, a brother-in-law, refuses to furnish a chalitza under these circumstances. So actually, the Beis Din of America came up with a modern-day, more elaborate form of this very document. If you take a look in the materials, I copied it, the chalitza agreement. On source 18 on page 5 says this agreement is made. This is the day of the wedding. It's generally done. It's among the sister-in-law, and if there are multiple brothers, you have all the brothers sign this agreement. Each undersigned brother solemnly promises that if heaven forbid sister-in-law to be requires a chalitza, they will arrange for a chalitza no later than 30 days following the request of sister-in-law to be. Again, the 30 days would have to be at some point after 3 months following the death of the husband, because chalitza can't be performed within the first 3 months. The reason it can't be performed within the first 3 months is because chalitza doesn't work if this is a machlokas, Reish Lakish, and Rabbi Yochanan in the Gemara, if the sister-in-law, the widow, is pregnant. If she's pregnant at the time, chalitza meuberes lo shema chalitza, it doesn't work, and you're not going to be able to tell. According to halacha, you can't tell if a woman is pregnant until huka ubra, until 3 months pass. We spoke about the 3 month benchmark in the context of abortion last week, but here for laws of chalitza, so you have to wait the 3 months. So as long as the 3 months have passed, which means it has to be 92 days. If you count the day of death and you count the day of the chalitza, so the day of chalitza can be no later than the 92nd day once you're counting the day of death as day one. I had one case where I think the brother-in-law was going to be out of town for a long time. He was only able to do chalitza on one specific day, and it looked like it was really close to the 92-day period. It was exactly on the 92nd day. And I must have gone through the calendar like 100 times counting to make sure that I got it exactly right. Because if you do it one day too soon, so according to the Ramah brings one opinion that says that's a chalitza psula. That chalitza is considered to be no good. So if there are other brothers in the picture, then the woman would not be allowed to remarry afterwards unless she did a chalitza with every single one of the other brothers. So here, since we had a willing brother, but he can only do it on that specific day, we had to make sure that it was, in fact, 92 days. Then we say here again, unconditionally, that's again, believe, tabios to believe hafroz is the lashon, I believe of the nakla shiva, and without payment or consideration, and according to the requirements of Jewish law. The Gemara even says, chalitza mutas kishera, a very fascinating thing, that in order to induce a brother-in-law to perform chalitza, you could say to the brother-in-law, if you perform chalitza, then the sister-in-law is going to give you $1,000. And then after the chalitza is performed, and he says, where's my $1,000? She said, ha ha, fooled you! So is the chalitza still considered to be good? So the answer is, the chalitza is still considered to be good. If you did that with a get, that you said to a man, give a get to your wife and we'll give you $1,000, he gives the get, and he says, I'd like my $1,000, and we say, ha ha, fooled you! So then it turns out that the get is very likely not a kosher get, because a get mutter is possible. What's the difference between chalitza and get? The difference, there are different explanations that are given, but the main explanation that's given in the Gemara is that a chalitza mutas is kosher because a chalitza cannot be done through a shliach. It can only be done by the parties themselves. When it comes to a get can be done through a shliach. A man can appoint a shliach to deliver the get to his wife. A woman can appoint a shliach to accept the get on her behalf. Anything which can be done through a shliach can be done through a tanai, and the tanai is considered to be binding. Anything which can't be done through a shliach cannot be done through a tanai. So if there is a tanai, the tanai is simply not considered to be binding. So it's this little quirk with respect to Hilchos Chalitza, that Chalitza Mutas is Kesheva. So we do have some weapons at our disposal, as long as the brother-in-law in question is not listening to or watching this shiur. And then the last paragraph says, any dispute arising under this agreement, or in any way pertaining to any chalitza obligation of the parties, shall be resolved by the betin, because what you want to do is to have jurisdiction over any dispute. If you simply have an obligation that you're not able to enforce, that the brother-in-law has to show up to do a chalitza, that's not going to get you too far. So therefore, you make it into a binding arbitration agreement according to civil law as well. You add an arbitration clause. I do not know of any court case thus far that has arisen where a court has required a man to show up to Beis Din for a chalitza. I don't know that it has actually happened, but it really could happen according to principles of a civil law that arbitration agreements, even in front of a religious tribunal, are binding. So therefore, this is a good idea to have people sign, you know, in the event that there might be a need for a chalitza down the road. So again, let's go back to our question. So which is preferable, Yibum or chalitza? It suddenly sounds like Yibum is the preferable thing. If you just look at the Psukim, it says, you know, just like the idea of Geula, it was considered to be an admirable thing for somebody to step in the shoes of Mahlon, in the case of Rus, right, and to take over the legacy of Mahlon. And when Ploni Amoni didn't want to do it, he was kind of looked down upon. If you look at the story, it wasn't Galech Tov Yigav and Lo Yigav, that it was considered to be a good thing for him to do it, and if he didn't do it, so then that was not quite as commendable, that was not quite as admirable. That's why his name doesn't go beyond Ploni Amoni. He became just like the John Doe of history. He became somebody not terribly remarkable. While Boaz, you know, is somebody who we view as a great hero in our tradition. So this seems like Yibum certainly is very preferable. And after all, Chalitza, it sounds like we're spitting, the sister-in-law is spitting. People make the mistake. They think that she has to spit in the face of the brother-in-law. She doesn't spit in the face. She spits down in the ground. She spits on the karka, and it's necessary for the dayanim to just see the spittle as it leaves her mouth. They have to see it go down. There are certain, in Eretz Yisrael, in certain places they have the practice that they have it go on a rock. They actually have it go on a rock, then they pick up the rock, and they show the rock to the dayanim and say, do you see the spittle that's on the rock? So we don't generally do it on a rock, we do it just that it should be on the ground, like Rashi says in his commentary in Kumish, it's ala karka, that it goes down on the ground. But if you look in the commentaries, the Beis Yosef and so forth, they say that the idea of the spinning is that this is that it is demonstrating a certain contempt that this brother-in-law is refusing to perform yibum. Now sometimes the sister-in-law doesn't want the brother-in-law to perform yibum. They don't necessarily want to do the mitzvah. They don't care for each other too much. And then we try very hard to encourage him not to want to practice yibum. But if you look in the Mishnah in Bechoris, we're still doing Daf Yomi in Bechoris over here, says the Mishnah in Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph that discusses what is the precedence of different mitzvahs where you could form one or the other. So it says mitzvahs yayibum kodemus the mitzvahs chalitza. The mitzvahs yibum really is considered to be preferable to chalitza barishona. That is what was originally the case. Shayu miskadim l'shem mitzvah, when they would just do it for the mitzvah. Because remember, as a general principle, it's an issur kares. It's a general principle, it's an issur arayus for a sister-in-law and a brother-in-law to marry each other. That's considered to be eishes ach. Even after the husband dies, if the sister then, if the widow then marries her brother-in-law, she's not an eishes ish anymore, but she's marrying an eishes ach. Let's say she does have children, that's an issur kares. So now we're going to relax what would normally be an issur kares, and we're going to say you're allowed to do it. You're only allowed to do it if you have good mitzvah intentions. If you don't have good mitzvah intentions, so then that could be problematic, because maybe then it goes back to the arena of being an avera. So that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, "Ve'achshav she'ein misgadin l'shem mitzvah." Nowadays, the people will perform yibum not because they want to do a mitzvah, but because they actually like each other. So that's very dangerous. Amru mitzvahs chalitza kodemes le mitzvahs hayibum. Therefore, we say nowadays the mitzvahs chalitza comes first. That actually is a machlokis between Abba Shaul and the Chachamim. That's if you take a look in source 2, this is Gemara in Yevamos, Daf Lamed Tes, Amud Beis. So the Gemara there over says that this was the assumption that the halakhas like Abba Shaul, that it should not be done because people will not have the requisite kavana. If they don't have the requisite kavana, but rather, let's say a man decides who's the brother-in-law, in this situation, decides that he wants to have relations with his sister-in-law, and thereby they're going to marry her. That's the fulfillment of Yibum. The fulfillment of Yibum is through the actual intimate relationship. And he only does it l'shem noy because he thinks she's pretty. L'shem ishus, he actually wants to be married to her. L'shem davar acher, or maybe she's rich and he wants all of the money. Ki'ilu pogei be'erva. It's as if he is actually violating arayus, the arayus of Eishes Ach. And the Chachamim say, no, Yevam and Yevo Aleh, Mikol Malkom, is perfectly fine. So the Gemara says that originally, the Chachamim said that you should do Chavitza rather than Yevam because we're worried people won't have the right intentions. Meikara Savilak Abashal, or the Besof Savilak of Abanim. And in the end, they decided that, no, the Halacha is really like the Chachamim. Torah says do Yevam, it's okay to do Yevam. Says Rabbeinu Tam, source number 3, Rabbeinu Tam says, no, even though the Gemara says that we went back to say the Halakha is like the Chachamim, after that we went back again. We went back again, and we decided to reverse ourselves to the original position. The Halakha is like Abishol, like the Mishnah in Bechoris indicates, that the mitzvah of Chalitza comes first, because we're worried that people are not going to have the proper intentions. And in fact, if you look at the Gemara in Yevamos and Daf Kuftes, Bar Kapora says that there are 3 things that people should always follow. We don't have to go through all 3, but one of them is Bachalitza Kabashol. When it comes to Chalitza, follow the opinion of Abashol that Chalitza comes before Yibum. So how do we paskin? It's a machlokis. The Machaber paskins the mitzvah Yibum comes first, brings the other opinion, but this is the main opinion brought by the Machaber. The Raman Simon Kuf Samach Hei in Ebn Ezer says, no, the halacha is like Abashol, that we do not allow the parties to perform Yibum. Ein manicham osam liyavim. Unless it's 100% clear that they have in mind that they're going to follow the mitzvah. So in the early 1950s, I believe there was a takana in the state of Israel, in the newly formed Medina, of both the Ashkenazic chief rabbi and the Sephardic chief rabbi, and they said, you know what, let us try to create uniformity in our practices. Let's try to be on the same page. Since the Ashkenazim don't do Yibum, they're worried that people won't have the proper intentions. So therefore, maybe the Sephardim should follow suit as well. So Yitzchak Isaac Alevi Herzog was the Ashkenazic chief rabbi. Rabbi Ben Zion Uziel, who was the Sephardic chief rabbi, they both agreed to sign a takana when the early takanas of Medina Yisrael. Henceforth, even the Sephardim shall only do Chalitza and they won't do Yibum anymore. Comes along Rabbi Yosef said, oh, what's going on over here? The Sephardim are capitulating to the Ashkenazim. They're Yotzim Biyad Ramah. Yotzim Biyad Ramah. This is a very, very dangerous thing. This is not something I'm going to tolerate. So he had, you know, his very romantic story of Romeo and Juliet. Not Romeo and Juliet, but Abraham and Juliet. Abraham Sharabi and Juliet Sharabi, they came in front of Rav Avaya Yosef. Rav Yosef was not at all shy about mentioning the names of the people he was paskening for. And Juliet Sharabi was a widow of her husband who had unfortunately passed away without any children. And Abraham Sharabi, the brother-in-law, wanted to perform Yibum. Rav Avaya Yosef said, I don't care that this was a takana that was agreed upon by the Sephardic chief rabbi. As far as I'm concerned, it's null and void. And therefore, I ruled that they can marry each other and perform Yibum. And he said, and in fact, this is what I did. He said that I arranged for this. Sheyesh le'afsher Avim Sharabi, the Avim is Yibimto, Juliet Sharabi, v'chein nase masa piaskamasi. And he writes in his sefer, and in fact, I carried this out. Some of the later Dayanim, more recent Dayanim, say, in principle, they agree with Rav Avaya Yosef, but they feel that it's not really proper on the turf in Israel to go against the ruling of the chief rabbis, so therefore they will allow the Yibam, let them go to Cyprus or, you know, Greece, somewhere like that, outside of the turf of Medina Yisrael, and perform the Yibam there, and then they can come back and do it that way. But the question is, if you are, I think by and large, the Takana did catch on. I could be wrong. I think in most cases people do Chalitza rather than Yibum, even in the Sephardi community, although I'm not an expert. I certainly will confess to that. So I can't say for sure, but certainly that's the Takana that's on the books. But in the Ashkenazic community, this is the Halacha. So do we say that when we paskin like Abishol in the Ashkenazic community, that we say that we hold like Abishol, that's Ki'ilu Pogea Be'eshis Ach, Ki'ilu Pogea Be'erva, that it says if the person is violating Eishes Ach, we're worried that people won't have the proper intentions. So does that mean that if there would be a Yibum, that it would not even count a Bidiyevit? So this is a Machlokis Rishonim. The Nemuke Yosef is of the opinion that it would in fact count Bidiyevit. Bidiyevit would be alright. He says, Lohave Mamish Erva, V'lachem Bidiyevit Kana. It's the Nemuke Yosef on Yibamas Yurchesam and Aleph. I didn't copy this in the sources. The Ramban and Yibamas Lamates on the base says, no, according to Abishol, Lo Kana. It actually doesn't work. It actually doesn't work. So this has important ramifications if you have a situation where Chalitza is impossible. How is it that chalitza can be impossible? Chalitza can be impossible if a person doesn't have any feet. Chalitza is supposed to be, I brought the chalitza shoe. The CRC has a chalitza shoe. Okay, this is not a usable shoe. I do not think this is a functional chalitza shoe. This is from Russia, Winnetz, I think, of, from 100 years ago. So it was used in the Bezdin of Rabbi Schwartz's father-in-law, Rabbi Pupko, who was the Av Bezdin in Willetz in Russia. And there are two reasons why I don't think that this chalitza shoe would be usable. One is that, as you can see, it's really falling apart. You barely even have like the clasps and the loops intact. The laces are certainly, as you can see, completely falling apart. They would have to be reattached. And also, the Jews in Russia were much smaller than Jews nowadays by and large. And you would need a larger shoe in order to fit people who have a size 10, size 12, size 14. Those days, everybody was like a size 6 or 7. I don't know. Most people wouldn't be able to fit their shoes, their feet, into this shoe. But it's made out of leather. As you can see, it's hard leather, because the pasuk says, "B'chason na'alo mi'araglo." What's a noun? So it's a pasuk in Yecheskel, and alech tachash. That it comes from tachash, which was a kosher animal that was used for the construction of the Mishkan. So it has to be made from the leather of a kosher animal. And it says that "B'chason na'alo mi'araglo" is to go up a little bit on the foot, go above the ankle. But "mi'araglo v'lo mi'alal," it doesn't go above the knee, so it has to certainly. It has to come to an end before the knee, and then you tie it around. The Gemara and Mishnayos describe exactly how many times you have to tie it. You tie it twice, and then you have a bow that you make on top of the second knot, and you have three clasps, which are in the shoe itself, that the clasps are made going from bottom to top, but this is really completely coming apart. Every single chalitza that I've done over the years has not been with this shoe. I can assure you, this is a very, you know, I'm sure that this shoe was very useful once upon a time, but I have used the same shoe for all 20 chalitzos, and it's a one size, it's a miracle shoe. It's a one, like an Eretz Yisrael shoe, Eretz Tzvi. It's a one size that fits all, no matter how giant the brothers-in-law have been or how small they have been. It's always been exactly the perfect size. I can't really explain it 100%. Special segula about the shoe that we've used. I've used it in many locations. Most of the chalitzas have been in New York. I traveled once to Philadelphia to do a chalitza. I did a chalitza with Rav Aaron Felder, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, which was a very, you know, special experience. We had a little bit of a halakhic discussion about the way that he felt it should be done and the way that we did it, but you know, eventually we reached an agreement. He had a chiddush that when the sister-in-law, the widow, bends down to take off the shoe, so it's brought down in the postgame that she should not put her knees on the floor, but he felt she shouldn't bend at all. She didn't even bend the knees, and that's a really a tricky procedure to carry out. But in the end, he was willing to bend a little bit on that point and be somewhat flexible, but it was a really special experience to do it with Rav Aaron Felder. And I did a couple of years ago with the Bezdin of Boston. We had a chalitza case, so we've had a number of chalitza cases. Two of the chalitza cases, interestingly, that I remember that we did, were with people who were relatively young. It was in the aftermath, unfortunately, of the World Trade Center tragedy. So in the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy, there were a number of young men who were cut down in the prime of their lives. Some of them were really in the first or second years of marriage, and they didn't have a chance to have any children yet. So we had to, and they left brothers, and they left widows, and we had to do two chalitzas. So that we did them actually on the same day. There was a memorial service. It was on Memorial Day. There was a memorial service where everybody came down to Ground Zero. Bezdin America wasn't that far away from Ground Zero, so the people who came in for the memorial service, after the memorial service, they came to the Bezdin to perform the chalitza in our offices. Yes. That's a separate discussion. We had the DNA shear just a couple of weeks ago. You could listen to the recording. Yes. Okay. So it does in that sense. It was, you know, certainly there have been very poignant moments in which we've done chalitzas, but we've used a different shoe. But this is what the shoe looks like. So again, what would be the halacha if you had somebody who didn't have any feet? Let's say that the feet were cut off up until the knee, and therefore, it says you can't do a chalitza above the knee. That's mi'ala al, so you can't do a chalitza above the knee. So what do you do in such a case? So it hinges on this machlokish. Do we say, when we paskin like Abba Shaw in the Ashkenazi community, that whenever a yibum will be performed, since we're worried people won't have the requisite intention for mitzvah, does that mean automatically it's an iser erva, and therefore we can't countenance it? So that's one question. A related question would be, what if two people perform yibum, and they somehow did it outside of our view, of our radar, and they're in the Ashkenazi community? Do we allow them to remain married? Do we say you have to divorce each other now? A third question is, let's say that they want to be alone in the same room together. Do we say that there's an Isser Yichud? Or do we say, no, it's fine if they're in the same room together, because what's going to happen? Worst thing that will happen is that maybe Yibum will break out, but, you know, maybe if it's okay at the end of the day, so maybe we should allow it. So we have these three different nafkaminas. So Rav Soloveitchik had the case, the first case, of the man who had the feet that were broken off. And Rav Soloveitchik, this is in source 13. So Rav Soloveitchik asked Rav Chaim Heller. Rav Chaim Heller was a great Lamdun who hailed from Bialystok, and he was the Abbez in Alumja, and then he founded a yeshiva in Berlin. Then he came to America, and he was a Rosh Yeshiva at YU. He was a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Kochan, and he passed away, I think, around 1960 or so. When he passed away, the Rav was not in New York at that time. It was one of these days that he was in Boston, and he flew in special for the Levaya because of how much he was makshiv of Chaim Heller. So the Rav would sometimes ask Shilos himself of Rav Chaim Heller. And he asked Rav Chaim Heller, what should I do? And this is recorded in the Nefesh HaRav by Rav Shechter Shlita. And V'siper Lana Rabbeinu Shisiyayis and Magrach Heller, he asked Rav Chaim Heller what he should do. So he said that he pointed out, if you look in the Achiezer, that's source 14, the Achiezer says, when it's not possible to do chalitza, so then even the way we paskin, we would allow yibum in such a case. But what did he add? He added, but when the yibum is done, it's done amenasli tenget. So it sounds like it's really a very b'dievid concession, but it's only if there's a get that's going to be given afterwards. Now remember, this is not a mere marriage ceremony. When we talk about yibum, it means that this double amputee would actually have relations with this woman, and then he would give her a get afterwards, and the get that he would give her afterwards would release her, so now she's free to marry somebody else. But she would have to have these relations with him in order that she would be able to sever the bond, since chalitza would not work. And that's the protocol. So I asked Rav Shechter, when I was learning the sugya, I asked Rav Shechter, did Rav Chaim Heller paskin that it was necessary to give a get, because it's such a b'dievid to allow yibum altogether, that even if we're going to allow the first relationship, we're not going to allow them to stay together? Or is it that we're just sort of assuming that they don't want to stay together? In other words, is this something that is a necessity, that it must be amenasli tenget, or would they be allowed to stay together anyway? So it's very interesting. There's a tshuva by the Ginas Vardim, by the Prima Gadim. So the Prima Gadim has a tshuva, the Ginas Vardim, in which he says that that in this particular type of circumstance, once a couple has decided that they are going to have yibum with each other, even if it wasn't authorized, once that they are together with the yibum, we don't force them to get divorced afterwards. In other words, the only concern of Abba Shaul was with respect to the first consummation of the relationship. But once the relationship has been consummated, so then it's considered to be 100% valid. Then it's considered to be a 100% valid relationship. And they are allowed to remain together afterwards. And because when Abba Shaul says that it is ke'ilu pogeh be'erva, dera guzma ka'ama le'milse, he's exaggerating. He doesn't really mean it. So therefore, they would be allowed to remain together anyway. The chiddush is that even though normally you can't divorce a woman against her will, in this particular case, a man is allowed to perform yibum if there's no possibility for chalitza, even having in mind that he's going to give her a get afterwards, despite the fact that she may not want a get. However, if they want to stay together, they could stay together afterwards.
Is there any ceremony like chuppah or shabbat brachos that for a marriage, for a yibum marriage, or no, it's just yichud? Is there any ceremony for the yibum?
For the yibum, there's, again, technically speaking, you could speak about there being Edim, you know, and things of that variety.
What, the
right,
Yichud,
you
know, Yichud, what?
For the Bia, before, you know, for, well, again, a him and a Edim, Yichud, him and a Edim Bia, so,
okay.
You know, that's, right.
So all there is a Yichud.
Right, but.
So if she's an Isha Nida, for example, then we don't say
you can't have it,
you can't have it
if she's an Isha Nida. You have to wait until she's not a Nida anymore. Okay. Right. And as far as the Yichud is concerned, it's very interesting because here you actually have a machlokis. The Ramah indicates that there is no Iser Yichud for a Yavam and Yavamah to be together. The Sefer Bris Avram, he says, no, of course there's an Iser Yichud because we paskin like Abishol, that we're not going to allow them to do Yichud. So the Vilna Gaon says, well, maybe we can countenance Yichud based on the assumption that when they are going to, if they're going to have relations with each other, Shema, Yikavim L'Shem Mitzvah, maybe they'll have in mind that they're going to do a L'Shem Mitzvah, and therefore we're going to allow the Yichud. So I would go further and say, no, maybe you can also explain the Psak of the Ramah, that we hold like the Nemuke Yosef, that when we say Kilu Pogea Be'erva, it's not really an Erva relationship, it's like a Dera Guzma type of statement, and even if they don't have the requisite kavana, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? That they'll have relations with each other, but at the end of the day, it's going to count. At the end of the day, it's going to be valid, b'di'evid. Okay, so the Maariv Tzchiya said, guess what? I have another reason why nowadays you shouldn't allow Yibum. What's the other reason you shouldn't allow Yibum, says the Maariv Tzchiya? Because we live in a very promiscuous age. And who says that this man who died without any children really died without any children? Maybe he had a child, it would have to be with a Jewish woman, that we didn't know about. You know, he has like some type of double life that he didn't necessarily share with everybody. Maybe there's another child out there somewhere. So the Maariv Tzchiya says that that's another reason not to allow Yibum nowadays. So that's a big question, because what do we say? We say it would have to be a Jewish woman, what? Because if he had with a non-Jewish woman, it wouldn't halakhically be considered to be his child. We have we say Uvein Ein Lo. When is it that Yibum Achalitz is required if he doesn't have a child? Ayein Alav. You have to look and see if he has a child. Even a Mamzer would count, but it still has to be a Jewish child. Otherwise, it's not considered to be his child. So the question is, nowadays, we live in a much more complicated world. So Uvein Ein Lo, the Sifri says that Mikol Makom, if he has Ayein Allah Mikol Makom, you have to, Uvein Ein Lo is Ayein, so you have to look and see if he has any children, if there's any child that's going to be good enough. So let's say that a man had a child with his wife, but it was through artificial insemination. So do we count that? Is a child born through artificial insemination attributed to the husband? We have a machlokis, beishmor, chalkos machlokik, and taz, and siman alpha, and Ebn Ezer, whether a man can be mekayim through a booth through artificial insemination with his wife. But taz says, I'm not so sure. I think maybe you have to be machmir, that it doesn't count as through a booth. If you hold like the taz, so then do you say that if a man only had a child with his wife through artificial insemination, another question the Rav has to ask, right? You know, after a woman dies, and she had a child with her husband, was a child born through artificial insemination, is that going to be good enough? So Rav Shaul Yisraeli says he doesn't think it's good enough, he thinks you have to be machmir, and the Sefer Chalitza Kehilchasa says no. It says, Uvein Ein Lo, Mikol Makom, that Ayein Olav Mikol Makom. That as long as you investigate and you're able to determine that there's some sort of a child that can be attributed to the father, so that's going to be good enough. Even if it was born through artificial insemination, that's going to be good enough to pater the wife from having to do chalitza or yibum. We had a case in the World Trade Center. I had two cases where we did chalitza. I had other cases where the woman was pregnant with the couple's only child at the time that the tragedy of 9/11 occurred, and then she just had to continue her pregnancy afterwards. If the child wouldn't make it to term, she would require chalitza or yibum with the brother-in-law. If the child would make it to term, then she wouldn't require chalitza or yibum. Baruch Hashem, all the children in that situation were born as healthy and viable children. One of them actually was from the community where I lived in Riverdale, and the boy was actually friendly with one of my sons. They were in the same grade with each other, but it was sort of touch and go. And in that case, the woman had a previous miscarriage, and you know, Baruch Hashem, this child was a viable child. But this was true in a couple of the cases where we had four cases where the women gave birth to their only child, either right before 9/11, like the week or two before 9/11, or in the months following 9/11. So the chalitza yibum was not required. But nowadays, the world has become even more complicated. What if the man left some zera? He contributed some zera to a sperm bank, or the couple was going through IVF treatments and he contributed some zera. Now she becomes pregnant from that zera a year or two after the husband dies. So does that count as his child, so that the wife would be exempted from having to do chalitza or yibum? Let's say there's a brother-in-law who's making her an aguna. He's refusing to perform yibum or chalitza. She has an out. She can use the zera of her husband. So Moshe Yisraeli dealt with this question, and he brought a proof that it would not work from a tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda, that's source 9 over here. The Noda B'Yehuda said, why is it we only wait 3 months to see if the wife is pregnant afterwards before we can perform the chalitza? Maybe we should wait 3 months and 3 days. Because, after all, it could take up to 3 days after a couple has a relationship before the ovum is fertilized, before you have a fertilization of the zera, in which case the pregnancy would not kick in until 3 days later, and the pregnancy wouldn't become discernible until 3 months and 3 days later. Rather, he says that if the fertilization only took place after death, this is a proof that it wouldn't count. So if she only became recognizable as pregnant 3 months and 3 days afterwards, and because the fertilization took place 3 days after the husband died, they had relations the day he died, and then the fertilization, you know, took place 3 days afterwards, that would not exempt the wife. But he says, this is really a big case. His case was a case where the child was born 9.5 months after the woman had died, and the question was, did this child really belong to her husband, or maybe to somebody else? So he said, well, even if it was a husband, maybe the reason it took so long was because the fertilization was pushed off by 3 days. So he said, in which case that wouldn't be good enough. But then in the end he said, you know what, we have to go after Rove. And the majority assumption is that it came from that the fertilization was immediate. And it's just that it was a very long-term pregnancy. She took an extra 2 weeks before she gave birth. But really, the fertilization took place right away. So he didn't want to rely upon his chiddush. But he said, this is my chiddush. And I'm not going to paskin this way unless other people follow in my examples. He said, Moshe Yisraeli. So it's a kal v'chomer. If even when there were direct relations with the husband, it's just the fertilization took place a couple of days later, that would not exempt the wife from chalitza yibum. Certainly, if she only became pregnant with her husband's seed a year or two later, that would not exempt her from yibum or chalitza. However, of Daniel Gashtetner, I think he was the Mechaber of Lahoros Nasan, so he wrote a letter in the back of the Sefer Chalitza Kilchasa, in which he took issue with this opinion of Shaul Yisrael. The opinion of Shaul Yisrael is also shared by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and the Mincha Shlomo, the posthumously published volumes of Mincha Shlomo, and he says that we have a pasuk of Lo Yimachesh Shmo Yisrael. That the idea is that we don't want to wipe out the zera. The reason why we require yibum machalitza is so that we shouldn't wipe out the seed of this man who died without any children. But if he has seed, and we're going to produce a child with that seed even 2-3 years later, so that's still going to be good enough. And he brings a raya from a Tosfos about chalitzas milberes, and he says that therefore on that basis that this is sufficient. So I happen to think this is a good argument. And that he also brings a raya from the Gemara that talks about what if there was a child and then when the husband died, then the child dies 2 weeks later. So in the meantime, this woman goes off and she marries another man. Let's say child dies, you know, 5 months later, but she married another man 3 months later. So do we say retroactively, it turns out she had no right to marry this other man? So says the Gemara, we're not going to say that retroactively because all the ways of the Torah are ways of peace and pleasantness, and therefore it can't be that the woman who was permitted to marry somebody else freely now is going to have that permission revoked after we already permitted her to be married. So we can invoke the same principle. Here, this woman, there's no zera of this man in the world when he dies. I mean, there was no woman pregnant with his seed. There was no child who was born. So she's allowed to marry somebody else because of this remote possibility. We're worried that, you know, that if she's going to produce this child, so then she would be allowed to marry somebody else. So if we're going to say that if this child is born, that she's not going to be able to marry somebody else based on the husband's zera, so that would be a violation of Dirachei HaDalkei Noam. Rabbi Yisraeli wanted to say the opposite. Rabbi Yisraeli wanted to say, what's the problem with Dirachei HaDalkei Noam over here? That she'll assume that she can do Yibum with the brother-in-law, and now it's going going to turn out that the Yibum is retroactively an Isser Kores when the Zera is born afterwards. But that's not anything to worry about. Number one, we don't generally perform Yibum. Number two, the example of Drachet Dachinom given in the Gemara was an example where we want to enable her to marry Lashuk. We want her to marry somebody else. So it's a more sensible that based on the principles of Drachet Dachinom, we're going to count the Zera that's born from her her husband's seed, even if that Zera, that seed, is used to impregnate her, or it could impregnate another Jewish woman too, for that matter, and bring a child into the world 2-3 years later. Just, I was sort of surprised that I came across a tshuva by Rabbi Yoshev. Rabbi Yoshev has in the Kovetz Tshuvos, he says that a man shouldn't donate his Zera to a sperm bank. Unless he's going to donate his Zera to impregnate his own wife and be Mekayim Pu'avu, that's okay. But if he's just going to donate to a sperm bank, so he says, I have three problems with that. Number one, since it's not for his own wife, and who knows how it's going to be used, it's Hotzas Le Zera Levatala. It's a waste of seed. Number two, he says, maybe it'll go into another married woman's body, and according to some opinions, I think the Malchei Lev, according to some opinions, that's going to create a mamzer, or confusion, that maybe this child will end up marrying one of his close relatives, will end up marrying his half-sister, so therefore it's no good for that reason. Number three, he said that maybe the wife, the man will die without any children, and they'll have donated Zera to this sperm bank, and therefore his wife will be perpetually in a state where she's considered like she's pregnant, since there's Zera in this world to be considered like she's pregnant, and therefore she'll be stuck, she'll be in limbo, because a Milberis has to wait until she either has a viable child, or until she's no longer Milberis, so that a brother-in-law would be able to perform chalitza. But now the brother-in-law will never be able to perform chalitza on her because she'll be in a perpetual state of being a Milberis. So I wasn't sure if that was like an absolutely compelling argument that Rabbi Yoshev was advancing, or he was just trying to throw in like as many considerations as possible to discourage people from donating Zera to a sperm bank, because it seems like a stretch to me to say that that's considered to be the equivalent of pregnancy, because there's some Zera that happens to be out there somewhere in the world. Now, the other types of situations that arise with respect to the chalitza situations nowadays is where you do know ahead of time that there's a brother-in-law in the picture who is never going to perform a chalitza. So we said that one thing you could do is to get the brother to sign this document. But let's say the brother's not at the chuppah. He's already an apostate, and he's never going to have anything to do with the sister-in-law ever again. So the Ramah says this is the one case where we allow the marriage to be al tanai. We allow the marriage to be conditional. When it's originally contracted, if you know that there's a brother out there who will never perform chalitza, you say, in the event that the man will die without any children, this marriage will retroactively be null and void. Normally, we have a principle, ain't tanai b'nisuin. This is the one exception to the rule. If there's a brother who's an apostate, or it could be a brother who doesn't have the requisite das, it could be a brother who's missing in action, we don't know what happened to him. Those are all the examples that are brought by the poskim. Why would we allow it in this case? So, Rabbi Yehuda Lebetzky, who is the author of this famous book, Ain't Tanai B'Nisuin, in Europe, that was eventually published or republished by Rechaim Moshe Grudzinski. So he says, because why is it Ain't Tanai B'Nisuin? Because a man doesn't want to make his marriage conditional because he doesn't want all of his relationships, his intimate relationships with his wife, to be declared immoral retroactively. But that's only if they're declared promiscuous and outside of the context of marriage while he's still in his lifetime. If this retroactive declaration that all of his relationships were outside of wedlock is only going to occur after he's already dead, so then that's okay. So it doesn't help in situations where a live husband is refusing to give a get, but at least when you have a husband who passed away, so then this is a possible solution. I haven't seen tonight couple done under the chuppah. It's not the easiest thing in the world, but this is something which is brought down in Shulchan Aruch as a possibility. Rav Moshe has this somewhat, you know, wild or surprising tshuva in Chelek Dalet Siman Kuf Kuf Aleph of Eben Ezer, where a man and woman did not enter into such a tanai, but it was very clear that the man was likely to die shortly after the marriage, and he had a brother who was part of the communist government who never in a million years would do a chalitza, where he said, had they known that it was still necessary to do a tanai couple, to do this conditional marriage, they would have done so, so it's considered as if they did so, which is a tremendous, tremendous chiddush. But, you know, everybody is entitled to, you know, Gadol is certainly entitled to a tremendous Kiddush. We're not entitled to such a tremendous Kiddush. Rav Moshe is entitled, but it's a very, very fascinating Shuba on the part of Rav Moshe. I'll just finish by mentioning that in the aftermath of the World Trade Center tragedy, so there were these two cases. So one of the cases involved a young man who was cut down after, you know, he was maybe 20 years old. He left a brother who was around 15 years old. You have to check and make sure he's a gadol and all that. But he left a brother who was about 15 years old, and he was the one who needed to do the chalitza. And he came into our offices at the Bezin to do the chalitza. And we asked him, you have to ask, are you doing this of your own free will and so forth? And he kind of looked at us and said, well, you know, I'd really rather not be here. This is like such a tragic situation. He lost his brother and now he has to come in and suffer the indignity of having the sister-in-law spit in front of him and so forth. So it was very uncomfortable and very difficult for him to undergo this procedure, but he went through it, like he bit the bullet, and for the sake of enabling his sister-in-law to go on with his life, and that was that. Then around 9 years later, I was invited to a Sheva Brachos in my community. I knew the Chassan, I knew the Kalis family, but I didn't know the Chassan per se. I was serving as Menayel at the Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchak Kochanan at YU at the time, and they brought in the Kal and the Chassan, and I came to the Sheva Brachos. It was like one of these things, my next door neighbor, they need a minion, they need a Dvar Torah, you know, I satisfied, you know, both criteria. So I showed up, and the Chassan comes over to me, and he says, so, you know, we know each other. And I look at him and I said, I felt really bad because I didn't recognize him right away. And I said, I'm sorry, what shir are you in? You know, I figured he's one of my tamidim. He said, no, I don't go to YU. He said, we met about 9 years ago after the 9/11 tragedy. I was that boy who came in. I was that teenage boy who came in and did the chalitza in front of the bezin. And now here I was at his sheva brachos. So I got up and I said, I gave my dvar Torah. And I said that I know that this is a chassan who is of the utmost stellar character in terms of the chesed that he's capable of performing. And I said, I'm not going to tell you all how I know that. It was just a very, very special moment. But that's really what Chalitza and Yibum are all about. They're about continuity. They're about continuity. They're about perpetuating Klal Yisrael. That's what the story of Ruth and Boaz is all about as well. The acts of chesed on behalf of family members, even distant family members, even when it's difficult, even when it's tense, and it's that type of chesed which leads to us making the bracha without shame of malchus that every chalitza ceremony, bracha shekhidisharim tzitzav yachukav, shel Avraham Avinu, that just like, you know, we say that Avraham Avinu said, b'chut v'ad sochnal, that because he didn't want to take even a shoe strap, when he rescued his brother-in-law Lot, also acting for, you know, on behalf of a family member, he wanted to do it out of the pure chesed, so he was zoche for the nal of chalitza, as the Medrash says. So too, it's that type of selflessness that led to the eventual birth of David HaMelech and for the dynasty of the Mashiach that we hope will come.
Amen. If you want to hear an interesting story in Jerusalem, a man on Friday was in a car accident. He was brought to the hospital and the doctor said he's not going to make it through Shabbos. He had a wife, no children.
Yeah.
His brother was in Russia, who is not a Mumer, Bach Mumer. She's going to be in Aguna. There's no way. But the brother in Russia had a daughter going to college in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
A daughter. And they brought the daughter on Shabbos to him on his bed.
Yeah.
And they permitted him to marry his niece on Shabbos. By marrying his niece, Yibum goes out the window because the brother can only do Yibum.
Oh, because this is the brother's daughter.
Exactly.
Right,
so that's the only time they permitted, I think it was Avidoshi, they quoted, they brought the daughter.
You could allow it. If Mamah is the case, then in the dire circumstance, you can allow a marriage
because
even on Shabbos.
He has to be both ones. And they permit him to marry a second wife, his niece, and that got her out of the thing. And the thing is, got her to think of this.
That ends up being, you know, the person who is the Shemeres Yavam, or even as a co-wife. Yeah. So that's Potem, Mina Chalisa, Mina Yavam.
It was a genius.
That's the first mission.
It was a genius to get that
marry the niece. So therefore, once the niece ends up being the wife, you know, being the Yavama, so she can't marry her father, then therefore the whole thing falls away. Because that's an error that can't be overcome. That's the first mission in Yavama.
Great for the Aguna situation.
That's an amazing story.
I found the article. I sent it to you. It was
please
amazing.
Please do. Okay. Great coda for this year.
Yeah. Go ahead.